Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, October 11th, 2022. The U.S. looks to ship more advanced air defense systems to Ukraine sooner than planned as Russia continues to rain missiles down on Ukrainian cities. President Joe Biden taking part in a virtual meeting of the leaders of the G7 countries with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, joining in, urging more and more advanced weapons to continue the battle to push back against Russia's invasion. U.S. Senate returns from recess briefly to start work on the annual defense policy and programs bill. It's over $800 billion, but the final votes on the bill and any amendments to it will not happen by the senators until after Election Day in November. Republican Senators Tom Cotton and Rick Scott going to Georgia to campaign on behalf of Republican Senate nominee Herschel Walker. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha with an update on why not as many Americans as expected or hoped for are getting the new variant-specific booster shots. And we'll talk about the concern that COVID could make a big comeback this winter with a Politico healthcare reporter. And a Supreme Court case about a California law that requires pork producers to raise pigs humanely in order to sell pork in California, but questions from the justices about whether that unfairly costs other states. And we start with the G7, a group of seven and top industrialized countries, holding an emergency virtual meeting on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a joint statement promising to support Ukraine for as long as it takes and warning Russia of severe consequences if Russia uses nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, and concerning the Russian missile bombardment of Ukrainian cities this week, the G7 saying they recall that indiscriminate attacks on innocent civilian populations constitute a war crime, and they go on, we will hold President Putin and those responsible to account. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking to the G7 leaders today, urging them to give his country more air defense weapons to defend against the Russian missiles. President Putin says he ordered those attacks in retaliation for a truck bombing of a bridge that links Russia with Crimea, a Ukrainian territory that Russia claims as part of Russia. More on all this from today's White House briefing with the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
The president, has made clear that the U.S. will support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Does that extend into next year? And how much is the White House thinking about how that level of support could be complicated if Democrats no longer control Congress?
So look, we've been very clear. But let me just be also clear about this. The support that we have seen, it has been bipartisan, right? The support that we have seen in the funding that has been approved by Congress, the $40 billion not too long ago, the most recent funding that we saw that was with the CR, that was bipartisan as well. And so you have seen both sides come together in supporting Ukraine, who is, again, fighting for their democracy, fighting for their freedom, and we will continue to condemn Russia and their unprovoked war, and we'll continue to do that. We will continue to hold them accountable. But again, don't have a timeline for you because this could end today if President Putin chooses. Again, this is his war that he has started, but we will be there for Ukraine to support their bravery as they are fighting against this aggression as long as it takes. Don't have a timeline. As we have said many times before, this war has gone on for too long.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre holding her news conference in the White House briefing room. The National Security Council Strategic Communications Coordinator John Kirby saying today the Biden administration is certainly interested in expediting the delivery of two National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems to Ukraine. It's a ground-based air defense system created by Kongsberg Defense and Aerospace and Raytheon. It can defend against unmanned aerial vehicles and cruise missiles. The NATO defense ministers are meeting this week at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium. The Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, saying the ministers will step up and sustain support for Ukraine and will work to increase protection of NATO's critical infrastructure. He also says NATO will go ahead with nuclear exercises this week, even as Russian President Putin is suggesting. He'll defend Ukrainian regions, he says, are part of Russia by all means necessary.
I welcome the recent announcements by allies to provide more advanced air defense systems and other capabilities to Ukraine. And I look forward to further deliveries. Our message is clear. NATO stands with Ukraine for as long as it takes. President Putin started this war. He must end it by withdrawing his forces from Ukraine. And President Lukashenko should stop the complicity of Belarus in this illegal conflict. On Thursday, I will chair a regular meeting of the Nuclear Planning Group. The fundamental purpose of NATO's nuclear deterrent has always been to preserve peace, prevent coercion, and deter aggression. Next week, NATO will hold its long-planned deterrence exercise, Steadfast Noon. This is routine training, which happens every year, to keep our deterrent safe, secure, and effective. President Putin's veiled nuclear threats are dangerous and irresponsible. Russia knows that the nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. We are closely monitoring Russia's nuclear forces. We have not seen any changes in Russia's posture, but we remain vigilant.
The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at a news conference at NATO headquarters in Brussels as defense ministers and secretaries from NATO countries begin their meeting this week on Russia's war in Ukraine and the response. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin representing the United States. You heard Jens Stoltenberg refer to Belarus and that country's leader. Ukrainian President Zelensky, in his speech to the G7 leaders meeting today, said, on the border of Ukraine and Belarus, we can place a mission of international observers to monitor the security situation. The format can be worked out by our diplomats. I ask you on the level of the G7 to support this initiative. And an article from Reuters explaining that Belarus this week announced its troops will be deployed with Russian forces near Ukraine, signaling a potential further escalation of the war. So far, Belarus, a close Russian ally, has been a staging post for the invasion. That from Reuters. Back to Washington, D.C., the U.S. Senate returning to session today briefly to start work on the annual National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA. The bill authorizes the Pentagon policies and programs, including setting spending limits. Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island, chairs the Armed Services Committee, and he says countering Russia and China is the central focus of this bill.
The NDAA authorizes $817 billion for the Department of Defense and $29 billion for national security programs within the Department of Energy. The bill contains a number of important provisions that I would like to briefly highlight. To begin, we have to ensure that the United States can outcompete, deter, and prevail against near-peer rivals. This NDAA confronts China and Russia by fully investing in the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, the European Deterrence Initiative, and Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. As part of this effort, the bill increases the defense top-line authorization by $45 billion to address the effects of inflation and accelerated implementation of the National Defense Strategy. This top-line boost will accelerate the production of certain munitions and increase procurement of aircraft, naval vessels, armored vehicles, long-range fires, and other resources needed by the service and combatant commands. The committee has also included an authorization of $1 billion for the National Defense Stockpile to acquire strategic and critical minerals currently in shortfall. This will go a long way to help meet the defense, industrial, and essential civilian needs of the United States. We also include additional support for our industrial base to produce the munitions needed to backfill our stocks while also keeping supplies flowing to Ukraine and other European allies. Many senators on both sides of the aisle have been actively engaged in this effort, but I especially want to recognize Senator Shaheen's leadership. She has been instrumental in pushing new authorities that can be helpful for the Department of Defense to address the current challenge we have and better posture us for the future. Senator Shaheen's work has been highly impactful in the direction we ultimately took, which is reflected in the amendment that Senator Inhofe and I have offered as part of the manager's package. Relatedly, America's capacity for technological innovation has long given us the strongest economy and military on Earth. But this advantage is not a given. It must be nurtured and maintained. To that end, this year's NDAA authorizes significant funding increases for cutting-edge technologies like microelectronics, hypersonic weapons, and low-cost unmanned aircraft. Similarly, it increases funding to support U.S. Cyber Command's Hunt Forward operations and artificial intelligence capabilities. And as we navigate threats of nuclear escalation from Russia and increasing capabilities from China, the NDAA enhances our deterrence by helping to modernize the U.S. nuclear triad. It also makes progress in ensuring the safety, security, and reliability of our nuclear stockpile, delivery systems, and infrastructure, increasing capacity in theater and homeland missile defense, and strengthening non-proliferation programs. Importantly, this year's NDAA provides a 4.6% pay raise for both service members and the Department of Defense civilian workforce. It also authorizes additional funding to ease the impacts of inflation on the force and provides resources to support recurring retention needs.
Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island, chair of the Armed Services Committee on the Senate floor today. Politico writing about the NDAA for the next fiscal year has this: staff are sorting through more than 900 amendments that members have filed to the bill on issues from support for Ukraine, service members seeking abortions, which nations can and can't buy F-16 fighter jets, and the looming threat that China could move against Taiwan. Today was just Senator Reid's opening statement on this defense policy bill. There will be no amendment debate or votes or final vote on the bill until after the November elections, allowing senators to campaign either for re-election or in support of other candidates. Well, two Republican senators, Rick Scott of Florida and Tom Cotton of Arkansas, were in Carrollton, Georgia today on behalf of the Senate Republican nominee from Georgia, Herschel Walker. After all those questions about Herschel Walker's anti-abortion policy position amid allegations that from a woman saying that Herschel Walker was dating her in 2009 and urged her to have an abortion and paid for it, Herschel Walker denies this. Here's Senator Cotton at today's event.
Herschel, I have to say, a lot of our old Razorback fans haven't forgotten what you used to do to the Arkansas Razorbacks. But they have no hard feelings because they want Republicans back in charge in Washington. And they know that Herschel Walker is going to help build a Republican majority in the United States Senate. And they know that Herschel Walker will be a leader in the Senate, just like he's been a leader in sports and in business for the state of Georgia. Unlike your current U.S. Senator, Raphael Warnock. Now, Georgia took a chance on Raphael Warnock 2 years ago, put him on a little trial run, and for 2 years, For 2 years, Raphael Warnock has been nothing but a rubber stamp for Joe Biden and the Democratic agenda. He votes with Joe Biden 96% of the time. And look at what that's gotten us. Record high inflation. 13% since Raphael Warnock got to Washington and started rubber stamping Joe Biden's agenda. That means for every dollar you had in your bank account just 2 years ago, it's worth 87 cents now. Why is that? It didn't just happen. It's not an accident. It's because Raphael Warnock and Joe Biden have spent trillions of dollars that we don't have. They've been printing money for 2 years.
Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, with Herschel Walker, and also Senator Rick Scott in Carrollton, Georgia, a campaign stop called Huddle with Herschel, a reference, as you heard Senator Cotton mention, to the nominee's former career as a Georgia football player and then a professional football player. Here is Herschel Walker.
They'll do whatever it takes, say whatever they have to say, because they want this seat right here. But I don't think they know that they woke up a bear. Hey, I'm not just a dog now, I'm a bear. So they got to bring more than that. Because what they don't know is, hey, the gas prices, hey, my family can't take that. What they don't know is wokeness in my military. No, my family can't take that. What they don't know is I don't want them calling my men and women in blue thugs and criminals. No, I can't take that. It is time for us to stand up. It's time for us to straighten up. And don't let them take us down in that elevator. Yeah, I think I'm sick and tired of it. I hope you're sick and tired of it. Yeah. Have you seen the crime in the streets? Yeah. Hey, have you seen that border wide open? Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you something you may not know. 70% of the drugs coming from that border goes through Atlanta. That means you're going to have all the crime. You're going to have all the human trafficking. And what is Senator Warnock doing is absolutely nothing. And right now, he's going to talk sweet to you. He's going to dress nice. But 2 years, he's been in office. And can you take six more of this here? No. You can't take six more of this. It's time for us to get champions there that's going to get behind our military. It's time for us to get champions there that's going to get behind our police officer. It's time for us to get champions there that's going to get behind our kids in school, that they can quit calling our parents domestic terrorists because they want to know what's being taught in our schools. Hey, just think about it. Pronoun. In our military, how do you identify in our military? This is war times. What happened to push-ups? Sit-ups? Because I can tell you right now, China, Iran, and Russia not talking about pronouns. It's time for us to wake up. Don't let them take us down in that elevator. They're lying to you. They're telling you it's the new normal. I'm telling you it's not. The new normal is let's get back to being energy independent again. Because I heard it one time, that I heard one great president say they have peace through strength. And we know it's peace through strength. But the problem is we're giving up our strength, and sooner or later we're going to have no peace.
Herschel Walker, Republican nominee for U.S. Senator in Georgia, to campaign stop in Carrollton. After the speeches, again, joining the nominee, two U.S. senators, Tom Cotton and Rick Scott. Rick Scott, questioned by reporters about the controversy surrounding abortion and Herschel Walker.
Just to be clear, though, have you had any conversations with Herschel Walker about these allegations, and what has he told you about them?
He's denied the allegations. Have you guys asked Warnock about the allegations against Warnock? Why don't you go ask him if he's denied those allegations? His wife did that on camera and called him an actor, because that's exactly what he is.
Senator Rick Scott with reporters. Again, the allegations from a woman saying that Herschel Walker got her pregnant in 2009 and urged her to have an abortion and paid for it. This all coming up because Herschel Walker now has a pro-life anti-abortion policy as he is running for Senate. Senator Scott referring to the allegations again against Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat from Georgia, running for re-election. A political action committee supporting Herschel Walker with a new ad. It begins with a slate that says Raphael Warnock's ex-wife police body cam footage domestic incident, March 2nd, 2020.
And he just starts backing the car up. I just can't believe he would run me over.
But I've tried
tried to keep the way that he acts under wraps for a long time, and today he crossed the line. So that is what is going on here, and he's a great actor. He is phenomenal at putting on a really good show.
34N22 is responsible for the content of this advertising.
An ad in the race for U.S. Senator from Georgia. Again, the beginning has a graphics on the screen saying that's Raphael Warnock's, Senator Warnock's ex-wife, police body cam footage from 2020. A political action committee supporting Senator Warnock also out with a new ad that goes after the opponent, Herschel Walker.
Herschel Walker facing devastating abuse accusations from his own son,
saying he has committed atrocities against him and his mother.
He threatened to kill us and had us move 6 times in 6 months running from his violence. Showing up at his ex-wife's house armed with a gun and refusing to leave. Even making violent threats outside his son's children's party. 6 moves in 6 months, running from Herschel Walker's violence. Georgia Honors responsible for the content of this ad.
A new poll from Emerson College and The Hill showing Raphael Warnock, the incumbent senator, leading the Republican challenger Herschel Walker slightly, 48% to 46%. Less than a month until Election Day, C-SPAN takes you across the country to debates in key House, Senate, and governor races that will shape the direction of Washington, D.C. and state capitals in the coming years. You can check out the live upcoming debate schedule and watch the debates that already happened at our website, cspan.org/campaign. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, confirmed in the past couple of days that he will likely resign from the Senate by the end of the year to become president of the University of Florida. He was unanimously recommended by the university's search committee. When he visited the campus in Gainesville on Monday, he was met by protesters, calling him homophobic and racist. CNN interviewed a sophomore, Ethan Ibe, who covered the protest for the school newspaper, saying many are concerned with Senator Sasse's past comments that show he is not in favor of same-sex marriage and abortion. When it comes to a community as diverse as UF, students overall don't feel he is a good fit. They consider him a political appointee, essentially. They believe it's a bad look on the Board of Trustees that named him the sole finalist out of 700 candidates. Senator Sasse on Monday addressed some of those concerns.
I understand well that the calling that I would have, if it works out over the course of the next month, that I'm chosen to be a servant leader, helping steward the team that is the administration at this place. That's a really different job and calling than the job that I've had representing 2 million Nebraskans at the federal policy and politics level over the course of the last 7.5 years. And so I think one of the great things about an institution of higher learning is that you admit and you encounter the fact that not everybody has the same ideas about everything, and it's healthy to wrestle through those conversations in a safe environment where we together deliberate about ideas. But the fact that I probably have different views on certain federal policy and political issues than some of you is not the same thing as what this job would be. So I'm happy to take any and all questions that Lauren leads us through, but I suspect a number of them are going to center on federal policy and politics, and that's fine. I'm happy to answer them. But I think it's also pretty important to get on from nouns that we might have disputes about, you know, like identity debates, and get on to the verbs of what this institution can and should and will build together, because this is a pretty exciting community that's moving forward in dynamic ways, and I'm delighted to potentially get to be a part of it. So thanks for taking time for me. What should we talk about?
Thank you. Our first question is, will you support your LGBTQ plus students as president of the University of Florida, having made statements expressing disappointment at the legalization of gay marriage in your past?
Yeah, so first of all, I believe in the universal dignity and immeasurable worth of every single person. All the tens of millions of Floridians, all 57,000 students, 56,000 students here, 30,000 faculty and staff, but 330 million Americans, 7.9 billion people in the world. Every person has immeasurable worth and dignity, and we need to create a community of inclusion and respect and trust where people feel heard and appreciated and cherished. So There are definitely federal policy issues where I've had disputes before about what decisions courts should be making versus legislatures. But Obergefell, for example, is the law of the land, and nothing about Obergefell is changing in the United States. So your question is, do I support and affirm everybody in this community? Absolutely. And frankly, one of my jobs would be to make sure that we as a community work hard for everybody to feel included. And one piece of that is making sure we understand what metrics we have to make sure we're getting better at being a place where people feel included.
Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, at the University of Florida in Gainesville on Monday as he met with students, faculty, and others in the community. This audio from an audio and video streamed by the university. Later on in that discussion, protesters showed up, and Senator Sasse could hear them outside the room.
Education should not be thought of as a cost, and education should be thought of as an investment. It's an investment you're making in your future and in your ability to contribute to your neighbors in the future. But it's also something that we as a civilization need to do to be sure we have sufficient human capital to be able to do the kind of work we need to do. They have good rhythm. You got to give them that. You know, a lot of times you get protesters and they're just a little bit off. You know, they're clapping on the 1 and 3 versus the 2 and 4, or vice versa. But I mean, they feel like they have their act together.
Senator Ben Sasse at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He is expected to be formally offered the position as school president and expected to accept and resign from the Senate by the end of the year. Senator Sasse was president of Midland University, a Lutheran liberal arts school in Nebraska, before his election to the Senate in 2014. Washington Today continues in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile video app. An article about COVID-19 at Politico.com begins, "The Biden administration is racing against the dropping temperatures to convince more Americans to get the updated COVID-19 booster shot amid low uptake numbers driven by confusion over the shot, declining cases, and profound pandemic fatigue." Coming up, we'll talk with the reporter who wrote that story at Politico. First, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, Dr. Ashish Jha, in the White House briefing room this afternoon.
We have updated bivalent vaccines that are designed to target the original version of COVID. I think you should see slides up. You do. Great. That target both the original version of COVID from 2020, as well as Omicron, the BA5 version that's circulating right now. And based on everything we know about immunology and science and vaccines, these updated vaccines should provide a much higher level of protection against infection, against transmission, and certainly against serious illness and hospitalizations and deaths. And just like people get the flu shot each year, even if you've had the flu in the past or if you got a flu shot the year before, it's really critical that everyone 12 and older should go get this updated annual COVID-19 vaccine. So you're protected this fall and winter, and you're protected year round. So my message today from this briefing room is very simple. Don't wait. Get your new flu shot and get your new COVID shot today. If Americans did that, we could save hundreds of lives each day this winter. As the Commonwealth Fund just put out a new report, a new analysis, they estimate that we can save as many as 90,000 lives and nearly 1 million hospitalizations if most eligible Americans got their updated vaccines.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, part of his opening statement at a news conference today in the White House briefing room. During the question and answer period with reporters, he was asked why not the expected number of people have been getting these booster shots.
If the administration is laser focused on protecting people from serious illness, why are the booster uptake rates so low? Does this reflect a failure on the part of the White House administration to get people boosted?
And yeah, so let's
start one last thing. Yeah. Why haven't we heard from President Biden on this directly, given that he has the largest megaphone? You know, we heard from so much early on in the administration. Why isn't he speaking about this?
So let me start off by talking about where we are with the fall, this COVID new COVID vaccine uptake. We estimate that, and again, we'll get new numbers from CDC, but as you know, those numbers always lag. We estimate that between 13 and 15 million people have gotten the new COVID vaccine through this past weekend. And we always expected this to build up over time. September, if you think about how flu vaccines tend to work, not a lot of people get the flu vaccine in September. People are just coming back to school. People are not thinking about the winter so much in September. It's really October as the weather starts getting cooler. I'm from Boston. People tell me this is Washington fall. But, you know, it is starting to get a little bit cooler here. I think as that happens, as people, we tend to see a big uptick in flu vaccines. We're expecting more people to get the COVID vaccine. And we're going to do everything we can to get the word out. And all of us are speaking about it. I think you've heard about this from the Secretary of HHS, from the Surgeon General, me. I'm sure you'll hear about it from the President as well. The President has talked about the importance of going out and getting vaccines and getting boosted. So we all are very, I think, synchronized on making sure this word gets out.
White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha in the White House briefing room. More on the COVID-19 response heading into the colder seasons. Joining us now is Krista Maher, Politico's healthcare reporter. Thank you so much for being here. Dr. Jha urging Americans to get the updated shot, and not many have. What have you found in your reporting?
That's right. What we found is that there have been about 5% of eligible Americans who have chosen to get the shot. So that's about 13 to 15 million people by the White House's count at this point, out of about 284 million people, 12 and up, who are eligible. So that's not a lot. I mean, it is significantly lower than the number of people who have chosen to take their first booster shot since boosters were first available. So that's about 35% of people who have gotten a booster shot. And this is really, really low so far, especially as we're heading into winter pretty soon.
We just heard a clip from Dr. Jha from the briefing, and he said this was always expected. The rollout was going to be slow. We expect things to pick up soon.
Yeah, the administration is staying optimistic that more people are going to get the shot sort of as, you know, it dawns on people that it's winter and COVID numbers are about to tick up and flu season gets started. But it is unclear whether that will happen. There is, you know, a very, very deep sense of weariness among people for listening to this kind of messaging. And people are also a little bit confused about what this shot is. Why is this shot different than the one that I got 6 months ago or 8 months ago or even 2 months ago? That information is not necessarily kind of breaking through to a lot of people.
The Biden administration requested a supplemental spending bill, billions of dollars from Congress to continue the COVID-19 response and prepare for future pandemics, and it was not approved. Republicans opposed to it. Is that having any effect on how they are now trying to get people to get this booster and take a possible new surge in cases seriously?
Well, they certainly say it is. Administration officials told us privately and have said publicly that the lack of congressional funding is having a direct impact on the number of people that they're able to reach. For instance, in how big their media buys have been able to be and how many events, for instance, they might be able to hold. So, you know, they are really drawing a direct line between the lack of resources and how big they can go in this campaign.
We're talking with Krista Maher, a reporter with Politico. They also talk about trying to make COVID an annual shot, like the flu vaccine shot. What are the statistics on how many people get the flu vaccine and would maybe get an annual COVID shot?
Yeah, I mean, that is really interesting. And Jha talked about it again today. I mean, there you know, what he is always saying is go get your flu shot and get your COVID vaccine at the same time. And it's part of what they're hoping to kind of bring into the ecosystem as something that people just do every year. They go get the two together. And actually, the two drug makers, Moderna and Pfizer, I believe are actually working on some kind of a combination of the two shots together. But as you can imagine, that would be a pretty complicated thing to come up with, considering that the flu vaccine has to be tailored every year. And as we've seen now, the COVID vaccine has to be tailored along with whatever strains are coming along. So that may be some time coming.
COVID-19 has been out of the headlines now for a little while. How prevalent is the virus in the United States? How many cases are still out there and deaths every day?
Well, the deaths are still ranging between an average of about 350 and 400 a day, which is just way too many. Anybody, by any account, by anybody that you talk to, nobody is comfortable with that number, and nor should they be. And yet, at the same time, as you say, people's attention has really turned away from this pandemic because, you know, if you are not elderly and if you are not immunocompromised or have some sort of health risk, it's really not impacting you the same way that it was, because we have vaccines and most people also have some kind of immunity because most people have been infected by this point. But at this point right now, I think Josh said the other day that something like over 70% of the deaths that are happening in that 350, 400 a day range are amongst people who are over 70 or 75. So, you know, there is a direct impact on our elderly population that I don't think anybody, if they really think about it, would be at all comfortable with or agree that this is something that we should just accept as a new normal.
And is there great concern that the numbers could rise this winter?
Definitely. There are already hospitalizations on the rise in several countries in Europe, which have been a very reliable indicator of where we're going to be in a few weeks or a few months' time. There is a very interesting paper out by the Commonwealth Fund that kind of shows what will happen if we continue on our current trajectory of vaccination rates through April. And basically, the math is that if we all get vaccinated, up to 80% of us, and go get our booster shots, we can save 90,000 lives. If we don't, deaths and hospitalizations are projected, according to these researchers, to rise pretty dramatically over the winter.
Krista Maher is a Politico healthcare reporter. Find her stories at Politico.com and on Twitter, it's at Krista Maher. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Wall Street today, the Dow up 36, NASDAQ down 115, S&P down 23. International Monetary Fund cutting its world growth forecast for 2023 to 2.7%, down from 2.9%. That was the estimate a few months ago. As Reuters reports, higher interest rates slow the U.S. economy, Europe struggles with spiking gas prices, and China contends with continued COVID-19 lockdowns and a weakening property sector. The IMF and World Bank are holding their first in-person meetings in 3 years due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A warning today from the acting U.S. controller of the currency, Michael Hsu, about cryptocurrency and the desire by some to integrate crypto firms with traditional financial systems. He says crypto companies often disguise their financial products to look like those of regular banks, hiding the risks.
My views on financial stability issues are highly informed by my experiences as a financial regulator during the 2008 financial crisis. This past July, FTX, one of the largest centralized crypto exchanges in the U.S., submitted a presentation to the FSOC in response to outreach on the Digital Assets Executive Order. The arguments in the presentation caught my attention because they presumed that integrating crypto and TradFi would enhance financial stability. I could not disagree more. Crypto today is an immature industry based on an immature technology. I'm not saying this disparagingly. in a recent interview, Vitalik Buterin, founder of Ethereum, called crypto today a, quote, nascent baby. His words. The promises of programmability, composability, and tokenization are intriguing and could, in theory, help solve a range of problems in the financial service system while unlocking significant efficiency and economic potential. But that promise cannot mask the lack of clarity on basic things like ownership, the ever-changing landscape of consensus mechanisms and technology, and the unabating volume of scams, hacks, and fraud. Integrating an immature crypto industry with a mature TradFi system without guardrails and gates would be imprudent.
The acting controller of the currency, Michael Tsu, at DC FinTech Week, hosted by Georgetown University Law Center's Institute of International Economic Law. He referred to FSOC, that's the Financial Stability Oversight Council. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal today. Bank of New York Mellon Corporation is now open for crypto business. The nation's oldest bank said it would begin receiving clients' cryptocurrencies on Tuesday, becoming the first large U.S. bank to safeguard digital assets alongside traditional investments on the same platform. The former chair of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, has won a share of the 2022 Nobel Prize for Economics. The other two U.S. economists that got the prize, Douglas W. Diamond and Philip Dibwig. It was for their research into bank failures and how the bank failures could be a cause and not just a result of economic downturns. Ben Bernanke is now with the Brookings Institution, and they held a discussion about this on Monday in his honor.
I'm incredibly honored, of course, to be a co-winner of the Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in the memory of Alfred Nobel, to give it the correct full name, the prize. It was completely unexpected. My wife and I shut off our cell phones when we went to bed last night, not thinking about this issue. And it was our daughter in Chicago who was finally contacted and called us on the landline to inform us that this had happened. So we were not waiting around for the call.
Ben Bernanke, who was chair of the Federal Reserve 2006 through 14, now a distinguished fellow at the Brookings Institution, at Brookings on Monday when the Nobel Prize was announced. A Supreme Court oral argument today dealing with the pork industry, but more broadly about what laws one state can pass and may affect commerce in other states. NBC News writes about it this way. Justices appeared conflicted Tuesday as they weighed whether a challenge to a California animal welfare law that bans the sale of pork derived from breeding pigs housed in confined spaces can move forward. During more than 2 hours of oral argument, several justices raised concerns about the potential impact if the court were to endorse a measure that its challengers say unlawfully regulates farmers in other states, citing a broad range of actions that other states could take. But there also seemed to be awareness on the court, which has a 6-3 conservative majority, that a ruling against California could impose new limits on states attempting to protect the health and welfare of their people. That from NBC News. C-SPAN has the full audio at cspan.org. Here's a couple of minutes of it. Justice Clarence Thomas questioning Timothy Bishop, attorney for the National Pork Producers and American Farm Bureau Federation.
When exactly is a state, intrastate regulation impermissibly extraterritorial? Well, because this, as I read California's law, it is about products being sold in California. Unlike some of the cases you cite, it's not reaching out and regulating something across state line or regulating prices.
Well, the test that we propose is that a state law that conditions sales on an out-of-state business operating in a particular way.
And how does California exactly do that?
You cannot sell pork in California unless you raise your sows in a particular way out of state. It's a condition on sale. That's very little different from Baldwin. Baldwin conditioned the sale of milk in New York, predicated on the Vermont producer being paid the New York rate. And it did that because it thought that it was necessary to pay Vermont farmers that much in order for them to use sanitary methods on the dairy. This court held that New York what if, could not what, project its legislation that way.
But what if California, and sorry to interrupt you, I apologize. What if California said a house has to be built according to certain rules, by certain standards, with certain products, hence excluding products that are made in another state? For example, it says that you can't build a house entirely out of wood, so you can't import wood from another state, like that's a lumber state, like Georgia.
That's different, Justice Thomas.
Why is it? I mean, it's affecting your product from extraterritorially.
No, a state may ban a product. There's no doubt about that. It could ban pork. It can ban lumber to be used in building houses. What it can't do is condition sales in the state on a business in another state adopting particular methods of production. That tramples on the other state's rights.
Attorney Timothy Bishop for the National Pork Producers and American Farm Bureau Federation before the Supreme Court. Questions from Justice Clarence Thomas. E&E Newswire writing about this case, saying that energy lawyers are also paying attention because the implications of the High Court's ruling in National Pork Producers Council v. Ross could extend beyond the pig pen to the way states set requirements for cleaner electricity, according to some observers. Also, some news from the Supreme Court today, months after they overturned the constitutional right to abortion in the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Today, the justices decided not to take a case out of Rhode Island that questions whether unborn fetuses should have constitutional rights. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.